Welcome to another week of our 4.5 year verse-by-verse journey through all of God's inspired Word. We are going to begin today in 2 Chronicles, chapter number 11, verse number 5. Then we'll jump over to 1 Kings, chapter 12, verse 25. We are looking at the fallout from the split of Israel. King Solomon died, I think, in the early part of 941 BC, after being on the throne for 40 years. After he is buried and Israel grieves, it seems as if everybody gathers to Shechem at the fall of the year, in the seventh month of the Jewish year, in order to not just simply declare the first official year of King Rehoboam, but also to mark the beginning of a sabbatical year. And so we have a delegation from northern tribes of Israel come and ask for King Rehoboam to scale back on the way that Solomon had been having their people treated in their hard labor for his work projects. And Rehoboam not simply refuses, but rudely refuses. And so the northern kingdom gets formed by a rebellion that takes place at this special gathering at Shechem. And Rehoboam barely escapes, as you remember, and immediately tries to get up a military force to take his kingdom back into full control. But God sends a prophet and stops that from happening. So everybody goes home, just like they were instructed. Now, Rehoboam must have been very frustrated by that, because now he has control of only about a sixth of the original part of Solomon's kingdom of the Israelis. That's about like some of the New England states wrapped around Washington, D.C., remaining in control of the government there while everybody else goes into a new country. It was a shocking turn of events. But Rehoboam doesn't have any choice in the matter because the people are not going to go along with him since the prophet told him to knock it off. Don't try to take the other part back. So what does he do? He begins digging in. He feels, I think, immediately just how weak his position is. And he starts building defenses in all of his cities. Now, he doesn't do it the first year, I don't believe, unless he violated the sabbatical year, because they weren't supposed to be doing work other than what was absolutely necessary during the sabbatical year. But 2 Chronicles chapter 11 gives a list of the cities that he begins fortifying. Rehoboam, this is verse 5, Rehoboam lived in Jerusalem, and he built cities for defense in Judah. He built up Bethlehem, and Etham, and Tekoa, Beth-Zur, Soko, Adullam, Gath, Marishah, Ziph, Adoraim, Lachish, Azekah, Zorah, Ajalon, and Hebron, fortified cities that are in Judah and in Benjamin. So he starts making kind of a ring of protection around Jerusalem so that he can't be easily attacked. He made the fortresses strong and put commanders in them and stores of food, oil, and wine. He put shields and spears in all the cities and made them very strong. And so he held Judah and Benjamin. Now, this buildup takes place over time. I think he probably started it as soon as he could, but he certainly would have really kicked it into high gear after the fifth year on the throne, because he will be attacked from from Egypt in the fifth year that he's on the throne. Egypt is counting itself as an ally to King Jeroboam in the northern tribes, because Jeroboam spent a couple of years down in Egypt in exile with the new pharaoh down there, Pharaoh Sheshonq. Okay, let's jump over. Actually, let's keep reading in 2 Chronicles first. Verse 18, Rehoboam took his wife Mahalat, the daughter of Jeremoth, the son of David. So this goes back some time ago, because Rehoboam, when he became king, was 41, so he's been married for quite some time. So he married back into his own family, and of Abihail, the daughter of Eliab, the son of Jesse. She bore him sons. Their names were Jeush, Shemira, and Zaham. After her, he took Maakah, the daughter of Absalom. This is not the Absalom of history, who bore him Abiyah, Attai, Ziza, and Shelomit. So it's going to be his second wife that bears the crown prince, we'll discover. Rehoboam loved Maakah, the daughter of Absalom, above all his wives and concubines. He took 18 wives and 60 concubines, and fathered 28 sons and 60 daughters. So again, you know that this is not the will of God. This is not the desire of God. God's plan was one man, one woman together for a lifetime, and that included for kings. But the ancient world had kings multiply their power through treaties, through business trades, and those were usually sealed by some sort of wedding connection between the king or the king's family and the other country or the other business. And so this guy is already well on his way to having a whole bunch of wives and concubines, just like his dad. Now, his oldest boy is mentioned in verse 22. Now, if Rehoboam's 41, then this guy could be like somewhere in his early 20s. Rehoboam appointed Abiyah, the son of Maakah, as chief prince among his brothers, for he intended to make him king. And he dealt wisely and distributed some of his sons throughout all the districts of Judah and Benjamin, in all the fortified cities, and he gave them abundant provisions and procured wives for them. So, just like I was talking about, over time, Rehoboam fortifies cities in a ring of protection around the city of Jerusalem. And as his sons become old enough, he marries them off to probably the daughters of leaders in those towns, makes special business deals, special arrangements with those leaders. And he puts his sons in those towns to be the frontline defense against any threats on the Rehoboam kingdom, because they have a vested interest in protecting their father's kingdom. So that's what's going to be going on in Judah. Let's shift our attention northward to what's going on in northern Israel. And for this, we need to go all the way back to when Jeroboam first became king. Now, you've heard me say that I believe that the meeting at which Rehoboam was to be coronated and the meeting time at which the whole rebellion started was probably taking place in the seventh month of the year 941 BC. That's the seventh Jewish month. So we're talking about, that would be probably September going into October. And so when Jeroboam is declared king, he also starts digging in. Verse 25 of 1 Kings 12. Then Jeroboam built Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim and lived there. So he decides to make Shechem his capital city. Probably a logical choice, because that's where he was declared to be king. And then from there he went out and built Penuel. Now Penuel is over on the east side of the Jordan River. It's in the Gilead area, not very far from Mahanaim, which is a fortified city. So it's another city tied with the history of Jacob. So he picks that as kind of the capital area for the eastern side of his country, because we'll discover that the Jordan Valley is such a natural barrier that northern Israel is going to be divided up into western northern Israel, which is the promised land as it was originally given, and then eastern northern Israel, which is kind of the annexed territories that were given under the time of Moses. And so he needs a capital for both sides of the river. Shechem and Penuel are them. Verse 26. Now this happens, I believe, very quickly. Every year, the Israeli people, by the commandment of God, were supposed to go to the temple for Passover, that's in the early spring, Pentecost, that's at the end of spring, and the switch off to summer, and Feast of Tabernacles, that's in the seventh month, that's in the fall. Every adult male in good health was supposed to make that journey as part of the covenant requirements. So immediately, Jeroboam sees a problem here. If his people keep going back to Jerusalem every single year, three times a year, their hearts are going to continue being connected to the city of Jerusalem, and by that, to the king on the throne in the city of Jerusalem. And so he instantly sees a problem with that. Verse 26 of 1 Kings 12. Jeroboam said in his heart, "Now the kingdom will turn back to the house of David if this people go up to offer sacrifices in the temple of he who is at Jerusalem. Then the heart of this people will turn against their Lord," meaning himself, "to Rehoboam king of Judah, and they will kill me and return to Rehoboam king of Judah." So he realizes if their alliances remain with the temple of Jerusalem, and they make these three mandatory trips every year, sooner or later, they are going to start associating with the kingdom of David again. Why should they have this Jeroboam guy running over them? The legitimate line is the David line. And then they will execute Jeroboam. So he sees that there's really only one way that he can fix this. Verse 28, "So the king took counsel. He made two calves of gold," which is interesting, isn't it? Remember that when Moses had been gone 39 days up on the top of Mount Sinai, the people began to think that he was never coming back again. So they went to Aaron, the second in command, Moses' brother. And they said, "We need to travel on to Egypt. We don't know what's happened to this Moses fellow. And we need our God to go in front of us. So you need to make us an image. And so what did Aaron do? He took gold earrings and he melted them down and he cast them in an image of what? A golden calf or a golden bull. Now, way back when we did the study on that event, I told you that in Egypt, out of the area from which the Israelites came, it was commonly believed that the Creator God was represented from time to time on planet Earth by a bull or a young calf bull. And so the idol that was used amongst the Egyptians to represent that god was always in the form of a golden bull or a golden calf. And so it seems as if that Aaron, in his panic, in his trying to make sense out of the situation, decided to have a representation of the Creator God in a form that the people of Israel were familiar with, having just come out of Egypt. Well, guess who's just been to Egypt? Yeah, Jeroboam. And while he was there in Egypt, he probably discovered a little bit more of his Israeli roots, that they'd come from this certain area, and that the Creator God in that area was represented by a young bull, and in imagery by a golden calf. So he wants the people of Israel to show their allegiance to the God who brought them out of Egypt, but he doesn't want them to go to Jerusalem. He wants them to go to other places. So he gives them a touch point. He gives them a visual reference point, an image. He breaks the commandment, you shall make no other gods, you shall not make any images of gods. He makes two golden calves. And then he said to the people, you have gone up to Jerusalem long enough. So, enough of this. You've been making the trip up to Jerusalem all these decades, all these centuries. You don't need to do that anymore. That's another country. Behold your gods, O Israel. Now, that's the way the English Standard Version goes. But I think he actually was trying to use the word Elohim, which is technically plural, in the same way they use it when they talk about he who is. Yahweh Elohim, he who is your God, is one. And you shall love your Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength, right? So he is trying to represent he who is by this image. He's trying to pass this off as not idolatry, but a continuation of what they've already been doing at Jerusalem. This, behold your God, O Israel, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And then he set one in Bethel, which is just the north edge of the tribe of Benjamin, on the road from Jerusalem up to Shechem or up to Shiloh. So it is a convenient southern location of worship. A lot easier to get to than Jerusalem for the vast majority of people living inside the northern 10 tribe Israel territory. And then the other one he put in Dan, up in the north, the northern extremity of the 10 tribes area. And so basically he made sure that everybody was within a day, maybe a day and a half walk to one of these two worship sites. Now I've been to the one at Dan. They've excavated it. There is the original worship platform in place where the golden calf would have stood. A golden calf was melted down probably a long time ago. And then right in front of it, down a series of steps, there is the sacrificial altar place. The base of the altar is still there. The altar itself was destroyed a long time ago. And so he puts up these two convenient worship sites. And that is where we read in verse 30, then this thing became a sin, for the people went as far as Dan to be before one. So some of the people went north three times a year, Passover, Pentecost, Feast of Tabernacles. Some people went south. The people living over on the other side of the Jordan would have gone east, or excuse me, gone west to one of these two places three times a year. And so it becomes a sin because this is idolatry. This is a failure to worship God at the place where he set his name. Verse 31, he also made temples on high places and appointed priests from among all the people who were not of the Levites. Now, we'll develop this idea a little bit more later. At first, I think he hoped he could get some of the Levites to go along with this out of their loyalty of being in northern tribal regions, but that fell through. And so he will instead start recruiting non-Levites to be his priests in his golden calf temples. And it wasn't just these two. He had some other ones too, apparently. Verse 32, here comes a new festival, because I think the festival of Feast of Tabernacles had already passed, and he didn't want to wait until the next mandatory festival, which was next spring, Passover, before he inaugurated this new worship schedule for the northern Israelis. So verse 32, Jeroboam appointed a feast on the 15th day of the 8th month, like the feast that was in Judah. That would be the Feast of Tabernacles in the 7th month. And he offered sacrifices on the altar. So he comes up with a brand new feast of the golden calves on the 15th day of the 8th month. And so that would have been probably roughly about a month or so after the rebellion, after the split took place. So he did in Bethel, sacrificing to the calves that they made, and he placed in Bethel the priests of the high places that he had made. He went up to the altar that he had made in Bethel on the 15th day of the 8th month, in the month that he had devised from his own heart, and he instituted a feast for the people of Israel and went up to the altar to make offerings. So his whole intention is, let's quickly get these people connected to these new worship sites and to the loyalty that they should have to the northern kingdom and to the northern king. So he is using religion to tie these people together. And this becomes a snare and trap for them. And it will be referred to quite a bit as the abomination of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat. So this is bringing us to November or so of 941 BC. Chapter 13. A strange little story. It's a story that's associated with this ceremony that we were just talking about that kicks off the beginning of calf worship there at Bethel. Chapter 13 of 1 Kings, verse 1. Behold, a man of God came out of Judah by the word of he who is to Bethel. He's not named. But God dispatches this young prophet to go and deliver a message of condemnation on the day of dedication of this new worship service, this new worship temple and altar at Bethel by King Jeroboam. Verse 2, the man cried against the altar by the word of he who is and said, O altar, altar, thus says he who is, behold, a son shall be born to the house of David, Josiah by his name, and he shall sacrifice on you the priests of the high places who make offerings on you, and human bones will be burned on you. Now, wow, that is very specific, and it is fulfilled exactly as described here. A descendant many generations down the line will become a king committed to wiping out false worship everywhere inside the boundaries of the Promised Land. And he will burn the bones of these very priests that are setting up this altar on this day, on this very altar, as a means of desecrating this exact worship site. Verse 3, and he gave a sign that same day, saying, this is the sign that he who has spoken, behold, the altar shall be torn down, and the ashes that are on it shall be poured out. So he says, and this is how you know this is all true. This altar is going to pop open, and the ashes are all going to pour right out of it. And that's when the king, meaning Jeroboam, heard the saying of the man of God, which he cried out against the altar at Bethel. And Jeroboam stretched out his hand from the altar, saying, seize him! So he's apparently actively participating in this inaugural dedication of this altar to the golden calf of Bethel, when this guy interrupts, and it only takes a few seconds for him to say what we just read. And immediately the king whirls around and points at this guy and says, seize that man! And his hand, which he'd stretched out against him, dried up so that he could not draw it back to him. His arm seizes up, stretched out like that, and shrivels up. And that's the cliffhanger we have to leave at this point. We'll come back here next time we get into the Word.